Charismatic, passionate, has integrity, humble, servant, faithful, inspiring, persevering, positive, flexible, driven. This is who we are that call ourselves leaders.
Helping business leaders grow themselves, their team, and their profits. This is the Entree Leadership Podcast. Now, here is your host, Ken Coleman.
Coming to you from the Music City, this is the podcast of leaders, by leaders, and for leaders. I'm Ken Coleman, thrilled to have you with us today. Coming up, our feature conversation is with one of the smartest men in America, Seth Godin. But first, I'm super thrilled. Folks, this is a special treat. Dave Ramsey in studio with us today, co-hosting the Entree Leadership Podcast. Dave, this is awesome. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Man, this is an incredible times. And I can't. We get to be on with Seth Godin.
I know, it's ridiculous.
You and me.
Co-conversation.
We're going to be talking to
together.
Seth Godin.
You're going to hear a great conversation.
Incredible.
Get out the writing utensils, the writing pad, or if you want to type it up, whatever you want to do, because it is going to be fantastic. But Dave, let's talk about this, because this is all born out of an event you cooked up, and you said, I'm going to call a couple buddies, Seth Godin and Gary Vaynerchuk. By the way, a tease, Gary Vaynerchuk coming up on the next podcast, so you don't want to miss that, and we'll tag team that conversation as well. But Dave, let's talk about Business Gets Personal. It's October the 2nd, and you can check it out while we talk about it, DaveRamsey.com, and just click on the event button, and you can check it out. It's going to be at the Rose Theater, gorgeous venue at the Lincoln Center, Dave. It's called Business Gets Personal. Why do we do this event?
Have you ever read a book or two or three from a certain author, and you started becoming just a fan, not only of the particular book, but of the what that man or woman was saying? And you just say, okay, every time that book comes out, whether it's fiction, whether it's nonfiction, whether it's business, whatever it is, you just become a fan. Well, imagine if you did that, and then you actually picked up the phone or hit an email, reached out to them, and found out they would talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, that happened with Seth Godin and I several years ago, and we struck up a friendship. Because I was just a huge fan of his brain, his writing, his blog, the books he's put out, 17 bestsellers. I mean, the guy's a rock star. Then more recently, Gary and I have struck up a friendship, and same exact thing. I just reached out and said, hey, man, I don't know if you know who I am, but I absolutely love this new book, Jab, 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 Right Hook. I just read it and crushed it, and man, I'm going to be up in New York. If you ever want to sit down and have a cup of coffee, I'd like to just put a face and a voice with all this energy I see coming out of you. Which is Gary is like energy personified. And so, yeah, he's like, yeah, I love it, yeah. And so, you know, it became this little mutual admiration society of we're fans of each other, but me more of them. And then I thought, man, I actually know Gary Vaynerchuk. I actually know Seth Godin. I wonder if, what if, I probably couldn't happen, but I wonder if they'd want to, and if they wanted to, if we could ever get the schedules aligned. And so I emailed him this little brief idea of us just doing a little business conference thing. And then we got on the phone, and man, it just, the three of us, you couldn't get a word in edgewise because we just talked. But it was magical. A lot of energy, a lot of oomph, and all of that now is culminating in this incredible thing that the only bad thing about it is it's probably only going to happen once.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's like a pinnacle thing. It's very cool. October 2nd.
All right, folks, it's going to be a great day. And again, we're saying this internally, and we believe this. This event, Business Gets Personal, will save you tens and tens of thousands of dollars. We believe it could save you as much as 10 years of doing business the wrong way, and we want to help you. It's going to be an unbelievable day. Here's how you learn more and sign up. DaveRamsey.com or 888-22-PEACE. That's 888-22-PEACE. And we've got a special code for you. Just type in Entree Leadership at the Business Gets Personal site on DaveRamsey.com. Entree Leadership is the code. You'll get this ticket $100 off. It's unbelievable. And trust me, it's going to be a special day. So we want to see you there.
Even at $100 off,
yeah,
these tickets are expensive.
Very expensive. And you're coming to New York.
This is not for everyone.
That's right. That's a good
point. And Seth loves to say it's not for everyone. He loves to say that everyone doesn't need to come. And that's true. I don't want you to go into debt to come. I believe in spending time with people who can give you information and inspiration you don't have otherwise. I do that personally, and I believe in this. This is a very, very unique event, and given the cost of the tickets and the fact you're coming to Manhattan, and you can turn into a great New York weekend if you're smart. Bring your spouse, that
That's
kind of
right.
stuff. But But aside from that, you know, this is a pretty heavy investment. So don't come over there thinking that this one thing is going to change your whole life. It's not. Mm. It's one of the things
That's right.
that you will do that will change your life if you're ready, if you're that kind of person.
That's great. So we'd love to see you there. Well, it's time for our feature conversation. This is a real treat. Dave Ramsey and I both got on the phone with Seth Godin. I think you're going to enjoy this. So here it is, our conversation with Seth Godin. Seth, we want to launch into our conversation today around this idea of things not working. I think all of us listening to this conversation today know what it's like to have something not work, and it's maddening, it's frustrating. And yet you write on your blog, and you encourage us in speeches and beyond, that we ought to be more optimistic when things don't work. Tell us why we should be that way.
I would like to think that most people who are doing something important are in the change business, that what we're trying to do is make something better. We're trying to connect people or fix something or heal something or build something. All of those things involve change. The thing about change is it's not guaranteed. It's totally different than Six Sigma running the factory floor, always having it work. Totally different way of thinking about your work and what you do. So if you run the, you know, Delco assembly line making radios, you better have a Six Sigma mindset, that your job is to go to work and have everything work. Make all those radios just like you did yesterday, but cheaper and faster. But if you're in the business of change, your goal is to do enough that some stuff doesn't work. Because the only way you know if you're doing your job is if you're getting to an edge where something isn't working. So I think that the mantra that we have to bring to the table is, I did a good job today, because I changed some people and I broke some stuff.
You know, I think the rate of change out there in the culture is so rapid that that's most everybody. There's very few of those Delco radio things really happening. Most of us are making a freaking mess, aren't we?
Well, I think that one safe place to hide is to persuade yourself that you're one of those people who needs to just comply. And so I try to leave a big fat loophole at the beginning for those people, and then someone like you states the truth. Is, you know, unless you're the guy on the pacemaker assembly line, I would really prefer it if you were making things better, not making things the same. The pacemaker guys, I would appreciate if they would not invent anything, just keep going. But for everybody else, I think it would be a good idea to make some change.
Yeah, it's there's and for me, I'm an old sales guy, so I always think of the that there's not really any failures, there's just experiments.
Right, no for now.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you figure that you're going to get a 99% rejection rate, that means every no gets you one step closer to a yes. And if you're doing the same pitch over and over again, you're making a mistake. But if your pitch, if your offer keeps getting better, those no's are priceless.
But for me, change is just a no. It's an experiment that failed.
Yep.
And we got to do it again. That's the way I look at it. So that's cool. Yep. Man, that's deep, Seth. That's why we got you, man.
That's exactly right. Now, Seth, Dave's a perfect example of somebody who's overcome the lizard brain. You talk a lot about this in your speeches, but for folks who haven't heard you talk about the lizard brain and how important it is that we understand it and then combat it when we're looking to make a difference,
yeah,
explain
and,
that.
And do it quickly, because I think Ken just insulted me.
Actually, Dave hasn't overcome his lizard, and neither have I. We're going to talk about that for a minute. Wild animals, lizards, foxes, Tyrannosaurus rex, these animals are wild for only one reason, and that is because right next to their brainstem is a section of the brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala's job is revenge, anger, safety, and reproduction. That's all. That's all it does. And it's right next to the spinal cord, so it can activate. So, the story I like to tell is you're on the airplane, you're 40,000 feet, 30,000 feet. You've studied aeronautical engineering. You know full well that no plane in history has crashed because of turbulence. You're busy writing a memo. The flight hits heavy turbulence. And what do? You close the laptop, and you use your entire force of will to keep the plane aloft, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, they're lucky for everyone else that you were on the plane, because without you doing that, who knows what would happen?
It's going down.
And who made that decision to stop everything and will the plane to stay in the air? The answer is your lizard brain. Because your lizard brain doesn't know anything about aeronautical engineering. Your lizard brain isn't able to verbalize. It's just a big hotbed of chemicals. And so we, you know, we're sitting at work, and it's our boss's boss calling us on caller ID, and we don't say to ourselves, oh, good, my raise is coming through. We say, uh-oh, I'm in big trouble. And the next step, because the chemicals are flowing, is I'm a fraud. They found me out. I'm going to get fired. I'm never going to get another job. I'm going to lose my home. I'm going to starve to death. I'll be dead. And we go in less than an eighth of a second. We can test this in the lab. Less than an eighth of a second from phone ringing to I'm going to die. And that is what the lizard brain does. Now, when you see someone like Dave who makes a ruckus regularly, it's easy to say, oh, that's because he's figured this out. He knows how to make it so the lizard brain never speaks up. But that's not true. What's true is instead of fighting the lizard brain, instead of putting it down, denying it, trying to extinguish it, people who make a ruckus dance with the lizard brain. They dance with it. They say, oh, I heard what you just said, noted, but I'm going to go ahead and do this work anyway.
Oh, that's good.
And so we can't say, I would like a perfect, safe institutional opportunity where there is no fear and where I make change. What we can say is, my job is to dance with the fear. And my last riff on this comes from the fabulous movie Singing in the Rain. And if you can visualize that movie, the key scene is Gene Kelly dancing in a rainstorm. But what you might not remember is that the whole time he's dancing, he has an umbrella in his hand. And he doesn't open it, because it's not called singing with an umbrella. It's called singing in the rain. And that's what we have to do.
Wow, that's great imagery. Really great. I want to follow that up, because I think we have a lot of entrepreneurs and leaders listening in today who are also raising kids. And I watched a speech of yours recently online where you cited the example of Lego, where our culture has purposely removed the possibility of things not working. And we're talking about this idea of change. And if you're going to change things, things aren't going to work all the time. How do we as parents raise kids to be able to understand that there is value in trying and failing and learning and trying again?
It turns out to be straightforward, but more difficult than most parents are willing to handle. So here's example number one. You're a soccer coach of seven-year-old kids. Is the goal of the game to win, or the goal of the game for your kids to discover new ways to play soccer and discover what works and what doesn't? It seems to me that every team of seven-year-old kids ought to be coached the second way, that what we ought to do if we're playing soccer when kids are seven is rotate every single kid onto the field and have them discover the joy of playing soccer, and if they score a goal, that's fine, but the question at the end of the game is, did you learn anything? Well, that's the way I coached soccer, and they kicked me out of the league, because that's not what parents want. Parents seem to think that there's a trophy shortage, and is they need to win. And the second example is your kid who is always on the edge of experimenting and learning new things and is, 14, comes home from school with one A, four C's, and a D. Do you say, what are you learning in the A class that's turning you on, that's exciting you, that you're discovering? Or do you say, we need everything to be a B or higher? Because if you're focused on grades, which are a report card of how someone has complied to an industrialized system of compliance, the kid will hear that from you. On the other hand, if you're saying, guess what? Michael Jordan has no idea how to do accounting. And guess what? Dave Ramsey probably isn't that good at ballet. Being well-rounded is overrated.
That's
so
right.
What we're looking for are people who are excited and engaged and willing to fail on their way to succeeding. As parents, we've got to live that. So that means you say to your 11-year-old, I'd like you to edit a Wikipedia article today. Mm. And when they're done editing it, you've got to be able to have an honest conversation about how they can edit it even better tomorrow, not say, you're not qualified to edit Wikipedia. Because when we start creating these cycles of people putting their work in the world and improving it when it doesn't do everything, that's when we're teaching our kids the right answer. Not when we say, what year was the War of 1812?
Yeah, I think the vast majority of Wikipedia articles could be improved by 11-year-olds.
A good point. That's absolutely right. Seth, I want to go back to your early career, because this arc of conversation we're on, I think it would be great for our listeners to hear from a story that pops to the top of your mind of an early failure or when something you tried didn't work and a real lesson you took away from it?
So when you say early, can it be as early as this morning? Because they keep happening.
Hey, it's your example, man. You take it.
You know, again, back to this mythology. Part of the mythology is that when Seth Godin had hair, he was failing all the time, but then he figured it out, and now he succeeds all the time. But that's the opposite of what's true. All those failures that happened to me early were priceless because they got me to the point of where I am today. And my job now is to keep failing because that's what I paid for, the privilege of continuing to fail. So, you know, I launch ideas that don't work. I start projects that don't work. I start projects that do work and then they stop working and I have to stop. I get threatened with arrest by the vice president of AOL if I show up on campus to apologize to her for everything that went wrong. I turn down opportunities that end up becoming really big. I could have started Yahoo and I didn't. I mean, there's this endless list of all these things I did do that didn't work and didn't do that should have worked. And I'm proud of all of them because my mantra is if I fail more than you, I win.
You know, I think the thing that I run into, there's this mythology among entrepreneurs because entrepreneurship sometimes is lonely. And it's kind of like people think everybody else's marriage is awesome and theirs isn't. And entrepreneurs think everybody else is better at business than I am, and I'm the only one over here that's lonely, afraid, and really, I really screwed up that last deal. And it's fun to figure out that Ken and Barbie are broke. You know, it's fun to figure out that if you run around with enough Seth Godins in the world, enough Gary Vaynerchuks in the world, you find out really that, and even, you know, enough Brad Paisleys in the world or Peyton Mannings in the world, you find out really the gleaming mountain of success is actually a pile of garbage. The only difference is you're standing on it instead of laying under it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Dave, that's a winner. I love that. You know, I think that one of the reasons that people like you, me and Gary, want to speak up is because it's not that we say, come on over here, everything here is perfect. It's we're saying the journey keeps being interesting, and we're trying to sell people on the journey, not the destination.
The body language when I'm speaking to a group of 2,000 entrepreneurs or 2,000 business leaders changes completely when I start telling stories of our screw-ups. It's the whole spirit in the freaking room changes. You've seen it too, hadn't you, Seth?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've altered the usual talk I give, and I'll probably include it when I see you guys in New York, is the very first story I tell is just how badly I screwed up my introduction to the internet and how it was due to the fact that I was too arrogant to see what was really happening around me. I just wanted it to be like it was yesterday, but shinier.
You know, this conversation leads me to something you wrote on your blog recently, Seth. I thought it was a great distinction. You said you've looked at your professional life in the scope of projects. So one project, next project, next project versus a career. And I think that's brilliant. And I think it really helps our psyche. What's the benefit of the project mindset versus looking at it as a career?
Well, the first benefit is it's true that when I started out 30 years ago, everyone I went to business school with set out to have a career, because that's what you did. Today, more and more people are setting out to string together a series of projects, each project teaching them something and earning them trust. And the only thing they have in common is that the audience wants to engage with them and that there's a new risk, not that there's the same boss and you're doing the same work. So for me, saying you're going have a series of projects is like saying you're going for a walk and each step is going to be an interesting step along the way. When you go for a walk, if you hit a pebble or put your foot in a pothole, you don't turn around and run home. You keep walking. And you say, that was interesting. I'll try not to step in that hole next time. But once you can free yourself up enough to say, projects. Projects get started, but I'm not allowed to start a project unless I'm prepared to finish it. Projects don't always work. Projects are about who can I touch, who can I change, who can I be trusted by. It becomes significantly easier to find a path to take you to a journey that you're happy to live because there's no ending. There's no destination.
That's good. Another one of my favorite phrases from you, Seth, is delighting a niche. This is a wonderful phrase, and it's something that all entrepreneurs need to really understand. Unpack that idea of delighting a niche.
Okay, so you grew up watching Batman and the Green Hornet and the Brady Bunch. You understand mass marketing at its finest. Every single person watching the same commercial, going to the same store, and seeing the same macaroni and cheese on the shelf. The way you succeeded in 1965 and 1975 and 1985 was making average stuff for average people, because mass marketing and mass merchants were right next to each other. Now, mass marketing has fallen apart because everyone doesn't watch the same TV show. A popular show like Mad Men is only seen by 1% of the population in the United States. And so it's a totally different dynamic. And then the second half is, because more and more stuff isn't being purchased at the local Target or the local supermarket, shelf space is available. So now, instead of making average stuff for average people, we make magical stuff for weird people. Weird people are people who have chosen to care, chosen to go to an edge. So if you're into fly fishing, you're weird, because most people aren't. And if you're into stereo equipment, you're weird, because most people aren't. And so this fragmentation is the enemy of Procter & Gamble. It's the enemy of Simon & Schuster. They're not in favor of everyone wanting their own thing. But it's a boon for entrepreneurs who can now suddenly compete against giant companies, because they have an advantage, which is they don't need everyone, they just need someone.
You know, Dave's a perfect example of this. Dave, I want you to speak into this, because you are the largest syndicated radio show in the country that's independent, number 3 in the country, playing and competing and beating the big boys in markets all over the place. And people told you forever, you can't do this. And then you said in our staff meeting today, this is a weird place because we want to be weird. I want you to speak to that, you know, following Seth.
And, you know, in the sense of what he's talking about, we became the third largest, not by getting the number one station in New York and the number one station in LA, which is how you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to get those two, and then Chicago, and then Miami. I'm still not on in Chicago and Miami, except if you count hundreds of thousands of iHeart listeners, mm-hmm. Watching our HDTV show or that kind of thing. But, we have made a really, really good living delighting our constituency on the second and third most popular talk station in the vast majority of the cities in America. Now, many times we've moved up to number one as a result of that, but it often started with just getting our foot in the door and then just continuing to churn, continuing to burn. And, sometimes people are paralyzed. I go back to the whole thing you're talking about with the project versus the career, and I think about these young people graduating from college right now, and everybody talks about, oh, they can't find a job. It's because they're looking for this freaking mythology, this unicorn of a career, instead of just starting a project. Like, if I don't start this magical, perfect career track, that when I'm 52, I'll just be lost. Well, newsflash, you're going to get lost 17 times before you're 30. And so go mess something up, dude. Go bump into something, for God's sakes. And you know, instead of, but they're, instead they like, I'm going to live in my mom's basement, and I'm going to wait tables until the perfect career comes along. And the perfect career is a unicorn. It doesn't exist.
I love that.
You nailed it. And, you know, the word accidentally needs to be stated here. No one accidentally tunes into your show 2 times in a row. Mm-hmm. And so being on the most popular station isn't the point. The point is having a show that would be missed if it was gone. And the people who would miss you make a point of tuning in, even if it's not on the biggest station in town, because they've heard about it. They know of it. The word spreads. And so you didn't force yourself into all those iHeart subscriptions. Mm-hmm. They happened because people sought you out. And that means you make something that people want, which is not the same as satisfying a need that already exists. It means inventing and causing change to happen, to do something that no one else but you can do.
That's a powerful point, Seth. And I want to pause here for our audience and just re-ask the question for you. If your business or nonprofit or ministry went away tomorrow, who would miss you? It's a powerful and haunting question. And it's really something we need to ask continually. All right, so Seth, we love your blog. I know Dave does as well because
you, I read it every morning.
You give out great stuff in a short amount of time. One of my favorite posts recently, folks, I'm going to read it to you. It's so short, and I want Dave and Seth to talk about it. It's called Back to the Drawing Board. Seth wrote, "Isn't the drawing board the place where all the best work happens? It's not a bad thing to go back there. It's the entire point." And that's the entire post. Seth, that's brilliant. Talk to us about the drawing board and why it is so essential.
Well, if the model is I'm going to build something and then I'll be done, the drawing board is your enemy. You get something done on the drawing board, you put it into the world, and now you're set. Now you have the mansion and the yacht and the Range Rover and people taking care of you and peeling grapes, and you're done. And I couldn't imagine anything worse, because now you're just going to sit around at home waiting to die. And what's the point of that, right? That the alternative is to say, what I do is I make stuff. What I do is I create projects. What I do is I try to impact the world in a positive way and make change that I'm proud of. And that means if you put a project into the world and it works for a while, high five, but it's not going to work forever. None of them do. There's no one riding a horse and buggy. Horse and buggies worked a really long time ago. They don't work anymore. So when it stops working, good news, you get to make another project. And this idea of not having to mourn the project when it hits a bump, but instead view it as an opportunity to go back to the drawing board, this is uncomfortable. It flies in the face of what we think we want in terms of stability, but I think it's the essence of what it is to be alive. And a simple example is, you might like brown beans and black rice, but if you had to eat it 3 times a day, 7 days a week, that would get old. That every time we make a new thing to eat, we don't say, oh, I have to go back to the drawing board, back to the kitchen, and invent a new way to enjoy my meal. We look forward to it. Well, the same thing is true with our projects.
You know, it's so counterintuitive, too, because I think our human nature is to control as many variables to create comfort as possible. And then when you actually say, as soon as it gets comfortable, my goal, if I'm a thinking person, is break it and start again. And not intentionally destroy something of value. I don't mean that. But this idea that the mythology of perpetuation is just scary stuff. That you're going to build something and it's just going to run forever, and without any change, without any adaptation, without any 2.0, 3.0, 3.642, and you know, it's just. But it's counterintuitive. We work so hard in our, I guess it's our lizard brain, to create the variables under, to control the variables in such a way that we don't have to fear anymore, and that we don't have to think anymore, and yet the very thing that we have to do is go back to those things. So that's the brilliance of your drawing board analogy. That's why you're the man.
Mm. Well, you're very kind. You know, if you watch a 4-year-old playing with blocks, here's what she doesn't do. She doesn't build a tower of blocks and say to her parents, it's perfect, now I need to go watch it forever, right? So don't touch it, I'm leaving it there forever. No, she knocks it down and builds another tower. That's what we were born
and to. Giggles.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's good.
Well, both of you gentlemen know very well that when you try to do anything, and these are entrepreneurs and leaders that see a problem, they see what could be and what should be, and they start a business to fix it. And when you do something that matters, both of you guys know that there's going to be critics. And you know all too well. And, you know, Seth, I want you to speak to this. You wrote about this, the idea of critics in high school, and you know, it hurts, but there's a way we got to handle. I love what you said in the analogy of high school on your blog. Talk about that.
I, like many authors, I'm not speaking for Dave because he's probably never done this.
That's
used to go to Amazon to read my reviews.
Oh, no.
Particularly my one-star reviews. And then one day I realized I had never once met an author who said to me, Seth, my writing is so much better now. I read all my one-star reviews and took it to heart, and I've improved dramatically. Because, in fact, it doesn't make your writing any better whatsoever. And so I stopped 3.5 years ago and have not read an Amazon review since then voluntarily. Sometimes people annoy me by sending them to me, but I've never read one voluntarily since then. And it's so freeing, because the response to the one-star review is, it's not for you. I made something, mm-hmm. I did my best, and if you hate it, it's not for you. It's for someone weirder than you, someone different than you. And we do not need to let the critic in. And if we do let the critic in, we do not need to take him seriously. What we need to understand is that person didn't hear what we had to say, or that person's different than the person we made this for. Let's move on. And I think that the lizard brain desperately wants us to go read those one-star reviews, desperately wants to let the critic in, to memorize every word the critic says, because then it can hide again. And if we're going to do this kind of dancing in the rain, it certainly helps to get rid of all the lightning and the thunder and just let it rain.
That is good.
That's just so kind.
It is, yeah.
No, I don't read my one-star reviews. I read other authors' one-star reviews. You know, I was thinking, I was reading a John Grisham novel the other night, and I jumped over, and John Grisham, in one of his novels, had 12,700 reviews.
Wow.
Now, I've got like 1,000 on my biggest selling book. You probably got 12,000 on yours, Seth. I don't know. I never looked at yours. But, after 12,000 reviews, I'm scanning down there, and the third one from the top, recently entered, in other words, was a one star. And I'm thinking to myself, who is arrogant enough to argue with 12,000 other people?
Exactly.
Who have given this guy, your mama did tell you were special, didn't she? I mean, you are not that special, boy. I mean, it's interesting to me. And, you know, it's the problem, though, I think there's a societal problem with this. There's always been critics, and there's always been trolls, but the problem is that the internet has given them a voice that outweighs their value.
Yep.
And so we have major Fortune 500 companies shifting policy based on a Twitter troll,
mm-hmm.
or based on somebody bashing them on Facebook, or somebody's opened up a yourcompanysucks.com and has decided to go to town on you. And it's some guy who's never done anything, or gal that's never done anything, and they actually really just need to spend their time in counseling. And yet we're shifting our entire organizational pattern to fall for this troll or these guys. And it's really, really dangerous. I mean, you need to respond to legitimate problems. I do on Twitter, on my Twitter account. If somebody, I know you're not a Twitter guy, Seth, but if someone tweets and says, hey, one of your endorsed local providers is screwed up, I immediately tweet back, sorry, one of my team will get on it, email it to that department, and they do get on it. We use it as a customer service mechanism that way. But the haters and the Dave Ramsey, you're just an idiot and you just don't understand about this and your politics are all wrong and, you know, Dave Ramsey's a moron, block, 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 because it just, it doesn't carry any weight once you understand who it is that's sending it.
Mm. That's good.
And what's fascinating, Dave, is that the generation that's coming up completely understands this. That, you know, you and I see a white tablecloth with one drop of red wine on it and we go, it's ruined. But there's so many scuff marks of everyone who's been on the internet since high school that there isn't this perception that something has to be perfect, that something has to be flawless. What it needs to be is interesting and evanescent.
Mm. Authentic.
That's good. I want to have both of you speak to this. We've been talking about the critics, obviously, but let's talk about the importance of peers. Men and women in your life who are wearing relatively similar shoes, if we can put it that way, and how important that is to staying the course, not being drug into the mess by the critics and people who just simply don't understand what it's like to wear your shoes.
Yeah, so when Dave asked me to work with him on this event in October, my instant answer was yes, and then my second answer was also yes. And the reason that my second answer was yes is the audience is more important than the people on the stage. That finding your fellow travelers, finding your audience members, finding people who, not just that you can sit next to for a day, but that you can keep in touch with for a lifetime. Oh, a cycle of people calling each other's bluff, a cycle of people saying, yeah, I know that you make barbecue grills and I make rubber ducks, but let's keep in this communication because your problems are going to be a lot like my problems. And actively seeking out a peer group that is more than just a cocktail party, actively seeking out a dozen people who will meet every month at someone's office and hold each other accountable and give each other comfort is one of the most priceless things an entrepreneur can do.
And even if you can't meet in their office, just to drop an email and say, hey, let me bounce this off of you. And you get back a one paragraph response, which I have done with you several times, and you've done with me once or twice. And, you know, and you've asked me to get involved in projects, which I was honored to do. But you find people like that that are trustworthy. They're worthy of your trust because of they're authentic, they're accomplished, and when they look at you and say something, you know it's not some character who's never done anything dropping a one-star review based on his arrogance. It's you know, I need to listen to this. I mean, Malcolm Gladwell addressed this, or Seth Godin addressed this, or Gary Vaynerchuk addressed this. Jack Welch said this. I need to look at this and think this through, and even if the person that you're interacting with is not necessarily a household name like some of those names I just named, if they're respected in that particular niche, like for instance, I got to sit in with a group of Christian men who were all worth in excess of $100 million. The vast majority of them were worth in excess of $1 billion, and spend 2 days with them and learn from them, and them learn from each other and empower each other on giving and generosity and creative ways to give away vast amounts of money in ways that are effective and not wasteful and not impulsive, and let them sit there and watch these titans. I mean, I was a wiener in a steakhouse, you know, watch these titans encourage each other, because there was a part of them that even at that level, discussing their vast generosity, still had a lizard brain fear. And oh, yeah. I think the lizard brain is beat up on by the group.
Yep.
That's good.
We are in those moments more afraid of being shunned by the group than we are afraid of the lizard. And so it pushes us to be brave.
Wow. Good advice there. Well, hey, Seth, before we let you go, you know our team and Dave, we're so excited about Business Gets Personal October 2nd in New York City at the Rose Theater at the Lincoln Center. It's going to be a fantastic day. Dave, you schemed with Gary Vaynerchuk and Seth to put this day together. Seth, we'll start with you, and then Dave, I want you to just tell our audience, maybe those who have yet to say, hey, I'm coming, I want to be a part of this. We believe this event's going to save them tens and tens of thousands of dollars of mistakes, even though mistakes are good, and we think it'll save them 10 years. Seth, what are you excited about on this day?
I guess the thing that I would say to somebody who's not yet coming is that they probably shouldn't. Because if you come with your arms folded and say, all right, show me, it's not going to work. But for the person who comes eager, and the person who comes open, for the person who can say, I am trying to not just change my market, but to change the way I walk through the world and to change what I keep track of. I've done this enough times, I've seen Dave do it enough times, that I am confident we can repay that eagerness by helping people feel like the path is right there. And only when, you know, it's great for me to be able to share this stuff online and great for Dave to be able to put it on the radio, but I think it's when we are breathing the same molecules of air and when we are in a beautiful setting that people are the most open to taking a leap.
You know, I was on my boat dock at the lake house this weekend listening to, I got a real nice little Bose speaker thingy that Bluetooth in, yeah, with my phone, all this. And I was actually sitting there reading a couple of different books and just chilling, and had some jazz music on. And it was good. The jazz was really good. But, you know, and that's a pretty cool place to listen to jazz and read a book on the boat dock, you know. But you know what's cooler is when you're sitting in the presence of that musician in a good jazz bar. And there's something different. Okay. The music is just different. And that's why live events are important. That's why we go to concerts.
I
went to an Eagles concert not long ago. I know every one of those songs. I was a child of that generation. That's how old the Eagles are. And but, I mean, you know, I enjoyed the freaking concert. And why? They sung the same songs. Now, I'm going to try not to sing the exact same song. Seth will try to bring something new as well. Gary certainly will. He can't help himself. But, you know, but the deal is there's something, those air molecules that Seth is discussing, that's why we go to a concert. And that's why you go to something like this. There's a different level of lift when you connect with this kind of thing. And, you know, and I got to tell you guys that are listening, Seth, for Dave Ramsey to get to be on the stage with Seth Godin and Gary Vaynerchuk is like, this is just huge. And it's such a rare thing for the three of us to be able to align our schedules and to find something as unique as the Rose Theater in Jazz at Lincoln Center. It's a world-class venue. And to be able to do something like this for us is a treat. Now, let me just tell you, when you go to a concert and the musician, it's a treat for them to be playing, you get a different experience than you go to a concert and they're on tour and they're tired and they wish they were at home. And we're not on tour. We're not going to be tired and wish we were home. All three of us are so excited to get to do this with each other and do this for you guys. It's just going to be a freaking treat. Seth says maybe you shouldn't come. I think he's wrong. I think if you don't come, you're an idiot. It's incredible. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You need to come.
Yeah, it's going to be a great, great day on October 2nd. We'll tell you more about that in a little bit. We got to let Seth go. And so, Seth, you know there's much love for you here on the Dave Ramsey team. And Dave is a big fan as well. We really appreciate you being with us. I know our audience is better for it, and we are too. Thank you, sir.
Oh, you guys are awesome. It's always a privilege. I have one last request. Dave, in October, will you sing a little Hotel California song?
I want to see that.
Yeah, brother, there's a reason I'm in talk radio.
All right, have a good one, guys.
Thank you,
Seth.
You
guys be good.
Bye.
All right, we want to thank Seth. He is a friend of the organization, of course, close friends with Dave. And these guys are busy, Dave. And so when they give us 35, 40 minutes of their time, it's a big deal. And I know our audience is much better for it. Can't recap the whole conversation, but I want to get your thoughts coming out of that on this idea of fear of failure. And there's this cultural norm, you know, that, hey, if I blow it, I've blown it. And we talked about that in the conversation to the entrepreneur, to the leader. I want you to address, how does the leader lead through their failure with their people? I think we've coached them a lot today on how they handle it personally. But then they got to stand up in front of 8 people or 18 or 80. How does a leader lead well when they have led the team into failure?
You better have set the table before it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And setting the table before it happened means that we have a culture of non-fatal failures. We don't shoot our wounded.
Right.
And every time you make a mistake, we don't fire you. We're not trying to hire perfect people. We're trying to hire people who are excellent, who are thoroughbreds. But every thoroughbred doesn't win every race. And so if you've done that, and you've already given them grace when they stumbled, the people you're leading, then when you stumble and make a bad call, and you stand up and you go, well, screwed that up, people. But by the way, we're not going to quit. We threw an interception, but we're not going to secede the rest of the game. It still is the first quarter. We got 3 more quarters. Every time a quarterback throws an interception, he goes sit on the bench and brood.
That's right.
So we're going to keep throwing the ball, and there'll be another interception maybe, but we're going to keep throwing the ball because that's how you get touchdowns. And, you know, in the midst of interceptions are touchdowns. So we're going to keep going, but nobody nobody said you work for a perfect guy, and we have a real clear reminder that today you don't.
All right, folks, that is just a sample of what you're going to get. And again, we'd love to have you. We want you to make sure that you really review the event at DaveRamsey.com. The event is Business Gets Personal. We'd love to have you there with us. We have a special code. Entree Leadership is your code to get a $100 discount at DaveRamsey.com or by calling 888-22-PEACE. It's going to be a fantastic day. Well, folks, that is going to do it. Before we sign off, I want to thank Dave Ramsey. And on behalf of our producer, Eric Anthony, and the entire Entree Leadership team, thank you so much for listening. We'll talk with you again very soon.